Ah, Luswig 2, Side 2.
Yeah, baby. It's more from what happened, but still life.
First, the acid didn't affect us at all. While we were driving, and we had to be cool and concentrated. We saw people dressed up to go to church. The whole thing of Sunday morning, and then we stopped the car in the parking lot, got out, walked into this place where you couldn't tell if it was dark or daylight, where these people had been, looked like they'd been going for days. All the chicks laughing, and everybody high on pot and junk and juice and acid. There was a jazz band playing, and it was as if we'd entered Dante's Inferno. The acid took over. We didn't have much money, and the waitress said, "Don't worry about it, I'll take care of you." She brought us free drinks. We started talking to the people at the table, a guy and these two girls in sexy low-cut dresses. At the time, I didn't have a horn. I think I'd hocked my tenor, so I was playing an old silver soprano sax I'd borrowed from Christine's brother. The girls saw the case and said, "What's that?" I told them I was a musician. They started giggling and flirting with me. I looked at Christine, and at that moment, something snapped in my mind. I looked at these empty-headed women. I looked around me at all these crazed, laughing people hiding in the darkness on a Sunday afternoon, trying to deny the existence of any reality, and I realized that I was part of it. I was doing the same thing I'd done as a kid, searching for something, and never stopping, never being satisfied with anything, always thinking something wild was happening in the next block or the next house. What I was doing with Christine was just the same. We couldn't possibly stop and relax and enjoy each other, enjoy life, because we were so busy trying to find the wild things that we thought we were missing out on. After paying all the dues that I'd paid, prison and everything, and here I was past 40 with my pierced ear and my beard, and I was still running. I thought of all the people that I knew that I started out with. They were all living out in the valley with nice homes, and they had two or three kids, their grandparents. They have nice clothes and cars and money in the bank, and they're into businesses. And they long ago stopped this kind of life. I looked at Christine and saw that strained look on her face. She looked like one of those tattooed tomboy bride with a tattooed beauty mark. This crazy girl is a child that wanted to be a jazz singer, playing a tambourine and borrowing money from her mother. It was outrageous. Here I'm hiding from a parole officer, taking acid, still trying to prove myself as a musician. I thought, my God, this is insanity. Now what is wrong? Why am I doing this? A lot of people. I loved Johnny Hodges and Duke Ellington's band, the way he played ballads. And in that band was Ben Webster, who had a rich, full tone, like Joe Thomas's, but more subtle. Joe Thomas was a shatter, and Ben Webster was more soulful. Then I heard Louis Jordan on alto, and he knocked me out. I liked Benny Goodman, I liked Charlie Barnett. And then all the Dixieland people, we didn't even know. They know that guy who played cornet, Livery Stable Blues, what's his name? I liked Roy Eldridge, and actually when I got with Benny Carter, I liked him, but I never attempted to play like any of these people, never. I'd seen the little book solos by so-and-so, taken off the record, every now and then I'd buy one and try it. But it wasn't me, it had no meaning to me at all. People influenced me subconsciously, but I didn't feel like any of them, and I didn't play like any of them. I'd go to sessions and hear other people playing and think, "Oh, that guy sounds like Willie Smith, that guy sounds like Johnny Hodges," and I used to think, "Well, maybe I don't play good. Maybe I'm on the wrong track." Just like before I was drafted, I heard Lester Young, he was with Basie's band, and boy, I said, "That's the one." He played tenor, though, and I played alto. I dug the things he did, but I didn't want to ape him. I ran into Zoot Sims. He knew all of Prez's solos and could sound just like him and hold the horn up at a 45-degree angle just like Prez did. I thought, why don't I sound like anybody else? What's wrong with me? Finally, I got with Dan Kenton's band, and people started telling me, man, you sound great. I asked, what do you mean? I want to know why. They'd say, I can tell it's you. And I thought, well, that's what it is. I wasn't wrong after all. I got drafted then, and I went overseas, and I played there, and everybody liked me. I came home 3 years later, and I assumed everything was the same like it was when I left. I'm not home more than a few days when this friend comes over, and he says, man, have you heard Bird or Diz? I said, Bird or Diz what? Have you heard Bebop? Bebop? I hadn't heard a word. I swear to God, I was feeling good. I've been playing in England. I had a style of my own. So he put on a record, Sonny Spit and Dizzy Gillespie. On one side was Salt Peanuts. On the other was Oop Bop Shabam, the Cougar Mop. We played these charts. Salt Peanuts was so fast. Jimmy Lunsford used to have a thing called White Heat that was real, real fast. Beyond comprehension at that time. These guys played faster than that, and they really played. Not only were they fast technically, but it had meaning in the song. They were playing notes in the chords I'd never heard before, and it was more intricate and more bluesy and more swinging and more everything. They'd gone from one decade to another, one culture to another, straight up. I heard it and I thought, Jesus Christ, what am I going to do? I heard this Sonny Spit just roaring, flying over the keys, swinging and shouting. It moved me so much and it scared me to death. Bird solo on this, Bird solo on that. They'd copy these things off the records and practice by the hour. Bird solos on his licks. Everybody sounded like him, with the same ugly sound. Guys I heard before who had beautiful tone, now all of a sudden had ugly tone. Out of tune, squalling, squawking. I didn't want to play that way. I realized I had to upgrade my playing, and I really had to learn the chords and the scales. So I didn't copy anyone. I didn't practice much, but I went out and blew and blew and blew and blew. And I rejoined Kenton, and I only sounded like me. Bird had a great ear for changes, a great blues sense, great technical ability. He was able to play real fast, and his lines were beautiful. Everything was thought out and made sense. I never used to like his tone, but that's personal, and a tone is like a person's voice. Now when I listen to him, I love the whole thing. Tone and all, he was genius. But when I heard Coltrane, in the late 50s, I heard Coltrane with Miles Davis. I heard the kind of Blue album. On that album, he played everything you can imagine. He played more notes than Bird, more involved than Bird, and I loved his tone. Everything he played held together and meant something to me. He really moved me. He's the only guy I ever heard in my life that I said I'd give my right arm to play like that. It happened slowly, but in 64, when I got out of San Quentin and started playing again, more and more I found myself sounding like Coltrane. Never copied any of his licks consciously, but from my ear and my feeling and my sense of music. I went into Shelly Man's Hole with a group. A lot of people liked what I did and really thought I was playing modern. A lot of others asked, what's happened to the old Art Pepper? When I got out of the joint the last time in 66, I had no horns. I could only afford one horn and I got a tenor because I told myself to make a living I had to play rap. But really what I wanted to do was play like Coltrane. In 68 I got the job playing lead alto with Buddy Rich. And that day in Las Vegas after the rehearsal I was blowing Don Menz's alto in the motel room. I was jamming in front of the mirror, blowing the blues, really shouting, and all of a sudden I realized, wow, this is me, this is me. Christine was there in the room reading a book, and at the same time, she looked up and said, all right, that's fantastic, alto, that's you. Then I realized that I had almost lost myself. Something had protected me for all these years. The pain was so strong, he almost destroyed me. That experience had lasted about 4 years. that I was influenced so much by John Coltrane was a freeing experience. It enabled me to be more adventurous, to extend myself note-wise and emotionally. It enabled me to break through the inhibitions that for a long time had kept me from growing and developing. But since the day I picked up alto again, I realized that if you don't play yourself, you're nothing. And since the day that I've been playing, since that day I've been playing what I felt, what I felt, regardless of what those around me were playing or how they thought I should sound. Time when I was playing at the Blackhawk in San Francisco, Sonny Stitt was touring with jazz at the Philharmonic. He came in, he wanted to jam with me. He came in, he says, "Can I blow?" I said, "Yeah, great." We both play alto, which is, it really makes it a contest. But Sonny is one of these guys, that's the thing with him. It's a communion, it's a battle, it's an ego trip, it's a testing ground. That's the beautiful part. It's like two guys that play great pool, wanting to play pool together. Two great football teams and two magnificent basketball teams. Just the joy of playing with someone great, being with someone great. I guess it's like James Joyce when he was a kid, you know? He hung out with all the great writers of the day, and he was a little kid, like, with tennis shoes on, and they said, "Look at this lame." They didn't use those words in those days. They said, "God, here comes this nut." And he told them, "I'm great." And he sat with them, and he loved to be with them. And it ended up that he was great. That's the way Sonny felt, and that's the way I've always felt. I said, "What do you want to play?" Sonny says, "Let's play Cherokee." That's the song jazz musicians used to play. The bridge, which is the middle part, has all kinds of chord changes in it. It's very difficult. If you can play that, some kid came around and he wanted to play, he'd say, "Let's play Cherokee," and count it off real fast. I said, "Well, beat it off," and he went 1-2, 1-2, and he was flying. He played the head, the melody, and then he took the first solo. He played, I don't know, 40 courses? He played for an hour, maybe. He did everything that could be done on a saxophone, everything you could play. As much as Charlie Parker could have played if he'd been there. Then he stopped and he looked at me, gave me one of those looks, "All right, sucker, your turn." And it's my job, my gig. I was strung out, I was hooked, I was drunk. I was having a hassle with my wife, Diane, who threatened to kill herself in our hotel room next door. I had marks on my arm, I thought there were narcs in the club. And I all of a sudden realized that it was me. He'd done all these things. Now I had to put up or shut up or get off or forget it or quit or kill myself or do something. I forgot everything. Everything came out. I played way over my head. I played completely different than he did. I searched and found my own way, and what I said reached the people. I played myself, and I knew I was right, and the people loved it, and they felt it, and I blew, and I blew, and when I finally finished, I was shaking all over, and my heart was pounding, I was soaked in sweat, and the people were screaming, the people were clapping. I looked at Sonny, and I just kind of nodded, and he went, "All right," and that was it. That's what it's all about. Read some stuff from Mingus's book, Charles Mingus's book, Beneath the Underdog. On Sunday afternoon in August, before their second son, Eugene, had begun to walk, Mingus said, "Barbara, find somebody to stay with the baby. Get Charles dressed and ready. I'm going to make it out to a session at Billy Berg's this afternoon. I'm going to take you and him." "Oh, honey, he's too young to enjoy anything like that." "No, he isn't, and I want his opinion." "Hey, Buddy, I got to call Buddy Collette." "Hello, Buddy. Can you make a gig out to Billy Berg's today? Here's your chance to show me what you're talking about with that Merle Johnson small lady mouthpiece and soft reed, because Charlie Parker's going to be there with his old out-of-tune self, like you said." "Yeah, I heard him with strings. Sounded to me like the strings were out of tune, and Bird was bending notes playing jazz regardless of what those overpaid motherfuckers, and not one black violin player on the session. Come on out. I want you to see him cut some. Musicians will start talking about you, because I know if you played like you played as a kid, with balls, Buddy, that's what's gonna happen. Later, Buddy." Daddy, hey boy, your mama coming with me to hear some music. I want your opinion today. Remember all the records I played for you, don't you? You remember Buddy? Yes, Daddy. You like Duke Ellington? Yes, Daddy. Duke. That's all I want to know. When I'm on the stand today playing with Buddy and Bird, that's Charlie Parker, the man with the same kind of horn as Buddy, you come up and stand by the one you like as much as Duke Ellington. All right, Daddy? Ready, Barbara? Coming. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the final set for the afternoon. Stan Levy drums from Dizzy Gillespie's group. Dodo Marmoroso piano. Lucky Thompson tenor sax. Who's he, Buddy? Cat from Basie's. Buddy Collette, alto sax. Charlie Parker, a gentleman from Dizzy's group. And Charles Mingus on the bass. And please, will all you people give Miles Davis a hand? Miles is just in from New York. Come on now, everybody. Miles Davis, give him a good California welcome. Okay, Bird, something everybody knows. Billy's Bounce? Don't know that, Bird. It's just the blues enough, buddy. Go on, take four. Dodo, blow. Miles. I don't blue, motherfucker. Now you got it. Blow, Lucky. Miles, why is his head so swollen? He sounds like a subtone Don Bias. What's that, country boy bass player? Cool it. Keep some time behind me. Keep your own time, Lucky, before I start playing your solos back at you. What, dig this cat with a bass? Come on, I want to hear that. Move over and share the mic, big head, so you won't be embarrassed. L.A.P. Dodo, stand, lay out, stroll. Motherfucker can play. What was that tag you added to my solo? Now how the hell you play like that? Laughing and talking. Bird, you hear this, country boy? Yeah, Lucky, did you? The same way we make the ooh da down on chromatics from C to C sharp to B to C natural, B flat to B and so forth. He just added a quarter tone glissando and put his heart in it. Don't genius, Mingus. Well, you motherfuckers gonna stop talking over there instead of just standing Dodo standing over there jacking off. Miles is so vulgar. I want to hear Bird blow, not all this dumbass conversation. So go on, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, Bird, play, baby, go, man. Ladies and gentlemen, will you all shut up and listen to this motherfucker blowing? Miles, careful, man, you can't say that. Shit, man, I put my hand over the mic on, motherfucker. Remember when Monk called the club owner in Detroit a motherfucker 7 times on the mic because he didn't have a good piano? Had it next night, though. If he'd called him sir, he'd had the same old clunker. Who's this Buddy Collette, man? This my best friend. He used to really play, but Whitey scared him white inside. He likes to sound white. He can read fly shit scattered on a fly swatter, though. And that ain't jazz. So tell him, Lucky. I will. First, I'll cut him in his own bag. Don't, Lucky. You'll bleed to death. Everybody in the studio click tried it. He plays flute, clarinet, everything, just like the white man says you're supposed to play, and a little fuller. Hey, who's that little boy holding on to Bird's pants leg? That's my son. Duke Ellington, Daddy. Daddy, Duke Ellington, Daddy. What's he mean? He's telling me he digs Bird. Look at old Bird smiling from cheek to cheek. He's sure a beautiful person. Go on, Dodo, man. That old face sure can play. And that drummer, too. What's his name? Stan Levy. He's a Jew. You know that Jew boy's got the soul on God. Nah, take it out, yeah. How about April in Paris, Bert? Sure thing, me, listen to this. Sounds like the millions of souls all wrapped up in that old ragged horn of his. Scotch tape, rubber bands, chewing gum, and they say he squeaks. Ha, squeak, Bird. He's just holding it, listening to it sing. Look, he's got your little boy in a trance. He can't even move. Lucky now, I heard him. He's the cat I've been hearing in my dreams. There's a man named Fats Navarro who was born in Key West. In 1923, he was a jazz trumpet player, one of the best in our world. He and my boy met for the first time in 1947, Grand Central Station, New York City. Lionel Hampton's band had just got off the train from Chicago. Benny Bailey, Gailey, said goodbye and split. He was leaving for Paris. The guys all stood around in their overcoats by the clock, waiting for the new man. A big fat fellow walked up carrying a trumpet case and added in there, out of his high, squeaky voice, Mr. Hampton, sir? And Britt Woodman introduced Fats Navarro. Charles felt embarrassed as the band walked out. There were strangers, women and children all around, and the guys were laughing too loudly and joking, and words like motherfucker and cocksucker echoed through the station. They took the shuttle to Times Square and another subway to Penn Station, boarded the train to D.C. It was my boy's first trip to the Apple. All he saw was underground. Later, when Hampton pointed to him, fastened it up, and played and played and played and played and played. One of the other trumpet players became resentful because of this new star in their midst and started muttering, "Shit, this guy can't even read." Fats laughed and grabbed the musician's part, eyed it, and said, "Shit, you ain't got nothing to read here." And he sight read from the score impeccably for the entire last show. Fats was featured all that week in Washington, and then they went on the road. The trumpet player whose parts Fats read with such scornful ease couldn't forget what had happened. He was a man who carried a gun, and he was convinced he'd been insulted. He was lipping a lot about he would kill Fats one of these days. They traveled by bus. The small instruments were in the luggage racks. The basses lay cushioned in the back row. The seats were assigned by seniority, and the one next to my boy was vacant and was given to Fats Navarro. Mingus and he hadn't talked much up to now. The first night out, the whole band was tired, and they settled down to rest as the bus headed west. Later, Mingus woke up feeling uneasy. It was past midnight, and everything was still. The men were sleeping, but the seat beside Mingus was empty. He heard a voice in the dark, someone pleading, "No, no, no." And a familiar little high-pitched voice screamed, "Don't you ever say you're going to cut or shoot somebody unless you do it here. Now, if you don't be quiet, I might cut you too deep. So hold still while I make you bleed a little, because when Theodore Navarro says he's going to cut you, that's what he's going to do." My boy felt the others waking and listening too, but nobody made a sound. Later, Fats came quietly back to his seat, and after silence, he said, "That wasn't no way to treat a new member. That was old-fashioned jealousy shit. Me and Miles and Dizzy and little Benny Harris played together, didn't have no old-fashioned jealousy shit. Why should any old member of the band be so uncourteous as to uncourteously threaten a new member?" Nothing was said afterwards about the cat who got scratched, and nothing more was heard from him about cheating Fats. "Mingus, I had note of you before you knew of me," says Fats. "Now, talking to Jacquette or someone else, you ain't undiscovered. Miles played with you once. He used to tell me about the band you guys had." "He did? He hardly said a word except with his horn. How cool can you get when a cat don't even say hello?" "That's the system, Fats. That's the system that keeps the blacks apart." "I see what you mean. So busy worrying how to make a dime with your horn, ain't got time to make a race. Gotta go downtown and see the man. Ain't got time to shake your hand. So we play jazz in this place." "Where's the place, Fats?" "Right in their faces. They know we know where it's at. They own us. Mingus, if they don't own us, they push us off the scene. Jazz is big business to the white man, and you can't move without him. We just work ants. He owns the magazines, the agencies, the record companies, all the joints that sell jazz to the public. If you don't sell out, you try to fight, they won't hire you, and they give you a bad picture of you. They give you a bad picture of you with false publicity. Sell out Fats to who? Look at Ellington, Armstrong, Basie, look at Hamp, all the big famous leaders. You can't tell me that the agents and the bookers own the guys like that. Mingus, you're a nice guy from California. I don't want to disillusion you, but I've been through all that shit. And I had to learn some things to get along. I learned better than to try to make it just with my music out on these dirty gang mob streets, because I still love playing better than money. Jazz ain't supposed to make nobody no millions, but that's where it's at. Them that shouldn't is raking it in. But the purest are out in the street with me and Bird, and it rains all over us, man. I was better off when nobody knew my name except musicians. You can bet it ain't jazz no more when the underworld moves in and runs it strictly for geeks and even close out the colored agents. They shut you up and cheat you on it. Count of your record sales, and if you don't go along, they tell the world. If you go along, they tell the world you're a real genius, and if you don't play, they put out the word you're a troublemaker, like they did me. Then if some honest club owner tries to get hold of you to book you, they tell you're not available, or you don't draw, or you'll tear up the joint like you was a gorilla, and you won't hear nothing about it except by accident. But if you behave, boy, you'll get booked, except for less than the white cats that'll copy your playing, and likely either the agent or the owner will pocket the difference. Fats, I know a lot of guys with managers taking a fair cut. 15, 20, maybe 30. Who told you that, Mingus? King Spook don't even own 50% of himself. His agent gets 51, 49 gives to a corporation set up in his name that he don't control. And he draws 500 a week and don't say nothing. But he's famous, Mingus. He's famous. But nobody didn't hold no gun on King Spook to sign no contract like that. It's a hard wrinkle, Mingus. I'm thinking when Peggy Lee be appearing in some East Side Club, her biggest applause come when she said, "Now I'm going to do the great Billie Holiday," and Billie be out on the street, and they all be saying she's a junkie. They had Billie so hung up they wouldn't pay the right way. They just put a little money in her hand every night after work, just enough so she come back tomorrow. That drives you to it, Mingus. They got you down and they don't let you up. If you're right, why don't some of the big Negro businessmen step into the picture? Because they ain't caught on. It's a diamond mine and they're too busy scuffling in their own coin patch and maybe scared. You're breaking into Whitey's private vault when you start telling Negroes to wake up and move in where they belong, and it ain't safe, Mingus. When the day comes the black man says, "I want mine," then hide your family and get some guns. Because there ain't no better business for Whitey to be in than Jim Crow's business. I guess you got something there, Fats. I noticed you and me staying in hotels like this one for twice what the white folks pay. Well, if things don't change, Charlie, do like I tell you. Get yourself some heat, guns, cannons, and be willing to die like they was. That's all I heard when I was a kid, how bad they was, and not afraid to die. To arms, and all that shit. Give me liberty and give me death. Show me where that atomic power button is, and I'll give them cocksuckers some liberty. You said money shouldn't matter to musicians, Fats. What if we all gave up fame and fortune and played because we loved to, like the jazzmen before us at private sessions for people that listen and respected musicians? Then people would know that jazz musicians play for love. I thought you had some children, Mingus. Don't they need no ends out there in California? I'm going to write a book and sell it, and I'm not going to play for money anymore. I'll compose and now and then rent a ballroom and throw a party and play some great musicians to come and improvise all night long. That's what jazz was originally. Began to complain he didn't feel good and he hurt all over and he wanted out. My boy thought it was just an excuse because they were all tired of the strenuous one-nighters. One day on the bus, Fats began coughing up blood. When they got to Chicago, he quit the band and left for New York. But my boy and he were to meet and talk again many times before the day in July of 1950 when Fats Navarro died in New York City of tuberculosis and narcotics addiction. He was 26 years old. Later. I was down on the hustling life. I wanted no part of it. I went to my artist friend and stayed in his studio like I used to. He'd come every day and paint, and I'd work at the piano. This was a good period again, the way it always is. Then Billie Holiday came to town, and Fats Navarro. It was the last time I talked to him. They were playing a concert for Norman Granz, and I went over to the theater to see them. "Mingus, I heard you was here. I knew you'd come. I've been here a while, Fats." "I know, I hear it. Come on backstage and meet the folks. You used a lot of weight, Mingus. Look at me. I made a record with Jacquette under the name of Slim Romero. How about that, Billy? Here's Ming. Mingus, honey, you on the show? Just come to listen, Billy." "Mingus, that you, baby? Girl, fat girl." "Goddamn, Mingus, why you still got to call me girl? Fats was bad enough. What's wrong with calling me by my name, which is Theodore Navarro? I'm sorry, Theodore." "Well, you can call me Fats now, because I'm getting skinny, and I know you love me, Mingus. You ain't like some of them other motherfuckers. They don't like me, but they don't even know it. I love you, Mr. Navarro. So be sure, because I'm leaving soon. Got your bags packed? What's that bag shit you talking? Or if I'm going somewhere, I pack up the things I want to take with me. I'm going to nothing, so I'm taking nothing, but I still ain't afraid to die like you niggas. That's where we clashed before, Fats, when you took those 50 dexedrines plus a handful of bennies all at once and said, fuck God. You scared me at first, so I got it figured out. Maybe I'm bleeding because I want to bleed. I got TB intentionally, and I'm hoping there ain't no heaven or hell like you say there is. Think how drug I'd be to get there and find a white man owns that too. And it's rent controlled in heaven and hell's the slums, I tell them. Kill me, white faggot cocksucking angels, like you did down on earth, because you sure ain't gonna get no work or rent from my soul. Dig it for yourself. Unless you let this earthly white angel shit all over you, you can't even have your soul cleansed white. Like, picture me giving my enemy my coat. Not even in New York City. Not me. Turn whose cheek to be smite on the other side? Shit, dig out a white man's black Bible is always gonna make some money and make somebody do something. Jeremiah 16th chapter 21st verse. Behold, I will just once cause them to know. I will once cause them to know my hand and my might, and they shall know that my name is the Lord. See, I remember that chapter. Because I had a girl named Mary, and she shows me this verse here. We're there. I don't dig nobody making me do nothing. I'm about to let God kill me just so I can meet him. If he's white, I don't dig him in the first place or in my place either. And as soon as the white angels pull me out of heaven, I'm going to take my share and heal the devil in his sleep. Put on his black skin suit, horns and tail, and stab away from this guy with old death, pitchfork right in his old foot, tap his old ass, and find his old lady. Fuck her good and make her kiss me all over my black ass while I beat her with my pointed tail. See, Angus, you look scared for me. Don't be scared if you don't. If all you believe in don't exist for me, I'll burn for my sin gladly when I know them white cocks up and so forth. Ain't gonna burn for theirs, Mingus. I still ain't scared to die. I'm not as scared as I ever seen even my mother and my family in Florida. You should see all the churches we got out in Key West. White man's got them too. I heard him praying once when I was little in some weird tongue. I later found out it was Latin. Imagine, a nigga hating southern white man that can't hardly read or write English, sitting in church looking holy with his big red turkey neck speaking in Latin. I snuck that in back, trying to get some of the white man's God magic spirit. The priest caught me, and you know what he said? God didn't want no little black nigga stinking up heaven. Or something? What I'm saying is as old as man's first time out. During the Stone Age, while the others were out with clubs beating each other up, some cats were thinking like this. Bird and I talked about this. Bird believe in God, niggas? You know he does. Someday one of us put downs, outcast makers of jazz music should show these church-going clock punchers that people like Monk and Bird are dying for what they believe. That duty's supposed to be left to holy men, but they're so busy building temples, they haven't got time for you and me. Dig? You say you're dying.
My church is too scary for me. They make that weird noise when you're going to have that thing. Ooh. Ah. Pictures of Jesus hanging around looking at your head. Black church, you get a show with your money, see. White church, all they do is Jesus was one for buy. Shorty to white people lately. I ain't seen no white folks no more. Y'all stop fucking? White folks into yoga. You can't get no nut doing no yoga. out fucking because some rich white man told them. Said, "Look, come on, cut the crop. Jesus Christ, there's too many people on earth. I have no place to ride my horsey."
A lot of niggas ain't scared. You know what I mean? You know, like when the Martians landed and shit, white folks got scared. I don't know.
Golly, I'll tell you, just a big old helicopter thing came down, landed. People got all had that fur all over their body. Big old claw hands and shit. Jesus Christ.
Nothing can scare a nigga after 400 years of this shit. I mean, hey, the Martian ain't got a chance, boy. A nigga warned the Martian. Better get your ass away from around him. You done landed on Mr. Gilmore's property. If he land in New York, a nigga take his shit from me.
Give up. You got to give up your flying saucer, baby.
Because I'm a macaroni. You know what I mean? He be cruising. Nigga be cruising.
Oh, yeah. It's sweet.
How much is petrol?
$82 million a gallon. Fuck this machine.
See? Now, mothers born in 1900, about, yeah, 1900. Those mothers, Jewish mothers, Italian mothers, are never hip that their sons are faggots. Out and out, screaming faggots, the mothers are never hip. A friend of mine, this is years ago, this guy's such a faggot, he's a truck driver. Now, that's so in and out. This hairdresser, interior decorator, he's driving trucks in. And he doesn't even bother, like, with no affectation of pastel colors, berets. He wears learned dresses and corrective shoes. Now, he lives with his mother for years. Real Orthodox Jewish woman with a shirt and a whole bit, right? The mother's never hit. Years and years and years. I didn't see these people now for 20 years. They went to Miami. They got some income property. First in Ocean. Good address? That is really schlock town, First in Ocean. That's where the dog track is. I figured that would really be a way to make Miami cook. You know, that the dog track, replace the rabbit with a couple of old Jewish women, you know. There goes Risky. Bam! Running in the dog chasing him. Really good, very bizarre kind of a... Now, he's down there with the mother. Haven't seen him in years. So I'm going to look him up. So I look. He's got his address. He cut his name out of the phone book. It's hippie. Ronnie Nadel. He comes to the door. He's got an anime Wong dress on. Okay. He's out of it. So he goes, "Oh, Lindy! Just about to put something on. What are you going to put on your schmuck? I know you, man. I talk to my mother. Dig the mother. Label, you won't believe something. I'm going to tell you something about Ronnie now you won't believe." And I go, "Oh, somebody copped out, man." "What's that, Mrs. Nadel?" "You're not going to believe it. Ronnie still didn't get married." "Oh, what a shock that is. How about that? And he ain't got a quarter yet. You know how good natured he is? Every night he's always bringing home a sightless man ain't got a place to sleep." "Oh, yeah. Wonderful." "I said, let him get shine to the earth. I'm like, schlepping Marines and sailors. He brings them every night. He's so good-hearted." Yeah. "They don't appreciate it. They punch him. They steal his rings and his cufflinks. Don't tell me that. I don't even know. But he loves Halloween. I'm hip. Yeah, puts Kay Francis hats on. Yeah, yeah. That's really like a mama's heart's kind of concept. Yeah.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night. Who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz. Who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated. Who passed through universities with radiant cool eyes hallucinating Arkansas and Blake Light tragedy among the scholars of money and war. Who were expelled from the academies for crazy and publishing obscene odes on the windows of the skull. Who cowered in unshaven rooms in underwear, burning their money in waste baskets and listening to the terror through the wall, who got busted in their pubic beards returning through Laredo with a belt of marijuana for New York, who ate fire and paint hotels or drank turpentine in Paradise Alley Death, or purgatoried their torsos night after night with dreams, with drugs, with waking nightmares, alcohol and cock and endless balls.
The instructionist book, you never make out at all, ever. It's really constructed so that's a zero, no score. Sell it for $45 in plain, wrapped, bound paper. Now it says in the answer, instructions here. Always go over the house for dinner and meet the folks. And don't forget, when you go over the house and meet the folks, you compliment, it's just a dialogue the guy's supposed to use. Say to the father, you know, "Oh, Mr. Johnson, boy, your daughter's got a terrific shape on her. God bless her, boy, she got a body, I'm telling you. And your wife has got a nice shape on her, too." Then, when you're out on the date, they like little jokes. There's certain kinds, maybe not for this generation, my generation, certain kind of things you just couldn't say, just verboten, that just cringe, embarrassing things. Then no one ever, here's a kind of stab your heart joke. Just keep saying, "What do you got, the rag on?" Keep saying it. They like that. They like people frank. "What do you got, the rag on? What do you got?" Keep saying it all night. You know. And then when you're in the car, if you just ask them in a nice way for it, just say, and be cute about it, use euphemisms, double entendre. Say, "Oh, I wonder if I could get some nookie." That's very cute. "Oh, boy, I wonder, would give me some nookie, boy, I wonder." And they just think that's so cute and you'll get it right away. And just say extra things like, "Boy, I appreciate it." That always gets, "Boy, I'd appreciate that, boy." A lot of marriages went west, you know, they went split up in my generation because ladies didn't know that guys were different. I mean, different, it's very tough for chicks to realize that although we speak the same language, that you can have babies. It's different. You're so, it's like no guy ever cheated on his wife, ever. But ladies would get hurt and want to leave the husband because they thought the husband's cheated, and they never did cheat, because what cheating means, I know, to a lady, means kissing and hugging and liking somebody. You have to at least like somebody. Guys, that doesn't enter into it all the time, no. Ladies are one emotion, and guys detach, not consciously detach, but they just do detach. Like, a lady can't go through a plate glass window and go to bed with you 5 seconds later. But guys can have head-on collisions with Greyhound buses in disaster areas. Everybody's laying dead on the highway. Not only the hospital, in the ambulance, the guy makes play for the nurse. Like, how could he do a thing at a time like that? "Oh, I got horny." "What?" "You're hot." "How could you be hot when your foot just cut off and you're dead?" "I don't know."
A supermarket in California. What thoughts I have of you tonight, Walt Whitman. For I walk down the side streets under the trees with a headache, self-conscious, looking at the full moon. In my hungry fatigue and shopping for images, I went into the neon fruit supermarket dreaming of your enumerations. What peaches and what penumbras. Whole family shopping at night. Aisles full of husbands, wives in the avocados, babies in the tomatoes. And you, Garcia Lorca, what were you doing down by the watermelons? I saw you, Walt Whitman, childless, lonely old grubber, poking among the meats in the refrigerator and eyeing the grocery boys. I heard you asking questions of each. Who killed the pork chops? What priced bananas? Are you my angel? I wandered in and out of the brilliant stacks of cans, following you and followed in my imagination by the store detective. We strode down the open corridors together, in our solitary fancy, tasting artichokes, possessing every frozen delicacy and never passing the cashier. Where are we going, Walt Whitman? The doors close in an hour. Which way does your beard point tonight? I touch your book and dream of our odyssey in the supermarket and feel absurd. Will we walk all night through solitary streets? The trees add shade to shade, lights out in the houses. We'll both be lonely. Will we stroll dreaming of the lost America of love past blue automobiles and driveways home to our silent cottage? Ah, dear father, gray beard, lonely old courage teacher, what America did you have when Sharon quit poling his ferry and you got out on a smoking bank and stood watching the boat disappear on the black waters of Lethe?
It's physical.